So the name of the game really is, if we have income, how can we defer income as long as possible? If I receive a dollar, like, I want to push it off. I don't want to recognize income because that means I have to pay taxes. How do we defer income as long as possible? We can do that through cash out refinances. If my property goes up in value, and if I sell at the top of the market, I also have to buy at the top of the market, right? Something I don't want to do. So one thing to defer recognition of income is to do a cash out refinance. The IRS treats a loan as a non-taxable event. You can pretty much harvest your equity gain in there without realizing the event.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Everyone knows the saying, there are only two things certain in life, death and taxes. But according to Ryan Bakey, what if the only thing that's certain is death? Ryan Bakey is a CPA and an investor who helps people boost their NOI and their ROI using the tax code. He bought his first investment property age 23, and he will teach you how to make money with real estate while avoiding taxes. He has a background in accounting and finance and has worked in Big Four consulting. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Sam.
Hey, man, the pleasure's mine. There's three questions I ask everyone who comes on. Can you quickly tell us, where'd you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Yeah, where did I start? I went to school for accounting and finance at a local Christian school by me. Started off in accounting and finance, and I learned to run numbers, profit and loss statements, balance sheets, learn how to run and analyze numbers. And I'm a first generation accountant in my family, but I learned so much throughout school. And it really wasn't until I would say my junior or senior year of college that I found the love for real estate. I was working at a small CPA firm by the school, and I had done this tax return. It was a married couple that made about $200,000 married, and they had about a $30,000 tax bill. And then I did a tax return for a single guy who had about $400,000 in cash flow real estate. So he was single. He made double the amount of money that the married couple that made less than he did. He paid less in taxes than the married couple who made half as much as he did. Even though he was in a higher tax bracket and made twice as much money, he still paid less in taxes. And I had asked my boss at the time, he's a CPA himself, I go, how is this possible? How does this work? And his simple answer was, it's because he invests in real estate. And that was kind of that shocking moment of, I need to know everything there is to know about this particular concept. And I need to know it quick because I want to be able to help other people achieve that goal. And also want to scale my own portfolio. So ever since then, four, five, 6 years ago, it's been game on, just trying to figure out ways that real estate investors can save money on taxes. And I've been guiding and advising people through it. And I kind of walked the walk, and I bought my first rental property, and I'm currently looking at short-term rental properties. That's what I have on the chop block now.
Man, that's fantastic. Love to stay, you know, on the tax side of this equation conversation today, just because I think this is where you're going to really shed some value to our listeners. I think that's the exciting part of this conversation. So walk us through, how did the guy that made 400 grand, did he just use depreciation? What were his strategies for reducing his tax liability?
So first, you have to start off and you just have to know the basics of the income. So by definition, there's two types of income. You have earned income, which is income that you make working at a day job. Maybe you're 1099, maybe you're an independent contractor. You have earned income. That's also going to include, maybe you have stock gains, maybe you have capital gains. That's all gets lumped in that ordinary bucket, okay? You have ordinary income, right? The other bucket is passive income. And so there's two types of passive income. By default, all rental real estate income is passive. So rental income is passive. And number two, any activity in which you do not materially participate in is also passive. So I invest in my friend's hair salon business. I give 10 grand a year. Hey, I'm hands off. I'm a passive investor in that business, which means that's passive income to me. So it doesn't have to be just real estate, but it could be you being a passive investor. And the biggest difference between those two is passive income is not subject to, number one, Social Security and Medicare taxes. The same way your ordinary income is. So if you look at your W-2 pay stub right now, you'll see two line items. You'll see one that says Social Security tax. You'll see one that says Medicare tax. The Social Security tax is 6.2% of your wages up to what's known as the FICA wage base, which for 2021 is $142,800. And every single year it gets indexed for inflation a little bit, right? Social Security Medicare tax exists for ordinary employees, W-2 employees. And if you're self-employed, if you're a real estate agent, if you're out there flipping, you know that you actually pay 15.3% in that FICA tax, right? So big difference right there, right away. And that's what I call the F word, the working man tax, because it's called FICA tax, the working man tax. But passive income through real estate doesn't have that, right? So there's no FICA tax. But then also, as you mentioned with depreciation, on the W-2 side of things, on the ordinary income side of things, there's only so many things that you can do to lower your tax liability. Outside of investing in retirement accounts, maybe you got an HSA, IRA accounts, and quite frankly, having babies, there's nothing you can do to lower your W-2 income lower than it's going to go. There's only so many things you could do on that side. But come over here on the passive income side, which this guy did, there's so many things that you can do to get your tax liability lower. One of those being depreciation. As we know, you know, depreciation's that tax-free, it's that phantom expense that you get. It kind of gets made up out of thin air, right? We're not actually coming out of pocket for, but we're going to get that expense against our rental income, right? If you've known about cost segregation studies, there's ways to accelerate that benefit and speed it up a little bit, right? That's on a high level, ordinary versus passive income. But then there's other strategies involved. If you're involved in real estate as your primary business, real estate is what you do on the day-to-day. Maybe you're wholesaling deals, and then you're also investing in rental properties, or you're fixing and flipping, or you're a realtor and you're investing in rental properties. There's a thing out there called real estate professional status, which allows you to use your rental losses that you generate from your rental properties to offset that ordinary income from your day job or your business income, right? And so that's a combination for a lot of people who do real estate as their primary bread and butter. Real estate professional status is a great way, because you could have somebody in theory that has $300,000-$400,000 of income, and it gets completely offset or wiped out because they have enough rental losses from their portfolio to offset the income. And remember, it's not a cash flow loss, right? All of this is tax arbitrage, and it's speeding up deductions. It's delaying recognition of income. It's a tax loss that you're able to take against your W-2 or your 1099 income.
It's the beauty of real estate. It's not even a secret, but who was it that said it's not what you make, but what you keep? It's that whole idea that, I mean, yeah, like you said, a couple making 200 grand a year and pay them 30 or 40,000 bucks just in federal income tax. Like, that's brutal, man. Talk to us, you know, what you're seeing on the short-term rental side of things. I think this is kind of a fun conversation where you were working through some clients maybe here recently. I don't know, we talked about this situation off air, but if you don't mind, can you kind of walk us back through that?
Yeah. So it all starts with regular long-term rentals. So your commercial properties, your syndication deals, your multifamily housing, those are long-term rentals, right? And long-term rentals are garnered under this section of the code that prevents you from taking those losses against your income. Like, maybe you're a doctor, maybe you're a lawyer, maybe you're an accountant, right? Prevents you from taking those losses against your income unless you qualify as a real estate professional. A real estate professional, again, like I mentioned, it's somebody who works in real estate full time. So there's a test in there that basically says you need to spend at least, you have to spend more than half your working time in real estate. So if I'm a CPA advising clients, right, I spend 2,000 hours as an accountant. That would mean I would have to spend 2,001 hours servicing my rental properties. That would be 80-hour weeks every single week out of the year. Now, I work 80-hour weeks sometimes because I'm an accountant, but I don't work 80-hour weeks every single week. And the IRS knows this. So there's no way I could qualify as a real estate professional. Okay. But now we talk about short-term rentals. Okay. So your long-term rentals, your passive losses, if you're not a real estate professional, you're not going to be able to use those to offset your W-2 or your 1099, right? But short-term rentals, because the short-term rental where the average tenant stays 7 days or less in your short-term rental, which is typically like an Airbnb or a Vrbo type prop, like a direct managing property, a lot of cabins, you know, the average guest might stay a weekend or 5 days or something like that. If the average tenant stays 7 days or less, it's not actually a rental activity under Section 469, which is where we find the real estate professional status rules. Okay. So that being said, you have an activity that isn't garnered under that same subset of rules. And now all we have to do is meet this thing called material participation. And there's 7 different tests to doing that. There's 2 that I like more than the other 5 just because they're easier to meet. And assuming you can meet one of those tests, and this does require you actually managing your property. And there are people who self-manage that self-manage remotely and are able to meet this. Just because they may live out of state doesn't mean they're not doing the Airbnb listings, or they're taking texts from guests, or they're having phone calls with guests, right? Phone calls with contractors. I wouldn't say it's easy, but it's able to meet those standards, even if you're out of state. So there's some people who are from California that invest in properties in the Smokies, and they're able to meet this requirement. But high level, what does that do? Well, now with that short-term rental, we can go and run our cost segregation study. We can want to speed up that depreciation. And now we can take that loss that if it was a long-term rental, we wouldn't have been able to take. But because it's a short-term rental and it's not garnered under the same subsection, we're able to take that loss against our high-earning income. I see a lot of doctors, nurses, physicians, lawyers that you know, they're making $500,000 on a W-2. They're making $350,000 and they're buying short-term rentals and they're participating in them and they're able to take the loss, the tax loss, to offset their ordinary income. And the numbers that I'm running, assuming high earner, about $500,000 purchase price on a cabin, the average client saving anywhere between $35,000 to $50,000 per cabin.
That's great. And that's independent of just straight depreciation or even accelerated depreciation, right?
That's wholesome of the accelerated depreciation. That the accelerated depreciation, what's dropping us down to that amount. But I guess that's not including, you know, your management fees or your expenditures, interest deduction, right? That's really just that accelerated depreciation.
Right, man, that's crazy. I mean, and I think one of the things that is unique in the short-term rental space is just that, I think you brought this up earlier, was that, I mean, you can get a secondary home loan. What'd you say, 10% down?
You're looking 10% at? Down. There's lenders that'll do 10%. Now that will factor in your debt to income ratio. So you got to play that dance of making sure you don't over leverage yourself. But there's also 15, now with that 10% down, and I guess this is getting away from the tax thing, so I'll only stay here for a second, but—
All right, it's cool, go, I love it.
With that 10% down, it factors in your DTI, and you're also not able to include the rental income for purposes of the calculation most of the time. See, now if you move up to the 15% investment loan, now there are lenders out there that'll do a 15% investment loan, then they will take into account the income that the property will generate or could generate per se, right?
So your tax savings alone on the deal, at worst case scenario on a $500,000 acquisition, I mean, it's a year and a half until you're break even. I mean, considering your cash in the deal. Yeah.
And it's almost, running through this with clients the other day, it's almost absurd how it comes out to be just about 10% of, it comes out to be that 10% that you put down on a 10% property. You know, I had somebody put about $1.2 million worth of a property into service. It ended up coming out to be 115. You know, I had a client $115,000 in tax savings by putting $1.2 million of property into service. $1.2 million times 10%, there's your 120 grand. Uncle Sam just funded your short-term rental ventures for that year.
Right, which is just, I mean, it's just kind of wild. It's you know, like this thing was Robert Kiyosaki that said this, there's two sets of tax laws, one for the informed, one for the uninformed. And it pains me, even when I'm talking to friends and people, you know, not in real estate, just going, guys, there is, like, you pay more in taxes than I do. It's just simple. I know you make less money than me and you pay more in taxes. It's not because I'm particularly smart or bright. It's just that there's, and watching them begin to educate themselves is fun. When suddenly the conversations are changing, like, hey, wait, there's a different way to do this. You mentioned something earlier that I wanted to circle back to, which is on the long-term, like multifamily syndications, right? Yes, we get accelerated depreciation. We get bonus depreciation until the end of what, 2023 or something like that right now. But you said that there's no way to take those passive losses unless we are a real estate professional. How does that work inside of a syndication? Even if you are a real estate professional, is there a way to break that out? I mean, maybe I'm missing something here, but can you kind of circle that thought again and see if you can clarify that for me? Because I'm not sure it's real clear in my own head.
So the whole idea behind that is to prevent your doctor or lawyer buddy from making $1 million, $500,000, investing in syndications, generating a tax loss through the bonus depreciation from the syndication and using it to offset his or her W-2 income. That's the IRS's whole workaround for that. They don't want people doing that. That's where remember what I said with a passive loss can only be used to offset passive activity gains. It can't go against your ordinary W-2 income unless you qualify as a real estate professional. But if you're in a syndication and you're not in the real estate field, there's no way you're going to qualify as a real estate professional.
So see, that's a common misconception. I think I've heard from a lot of people is that, hey, you know, get your bonus depreciation, take those things, but you're telling me that it only singularly applies to passive income. So if you're a passive investor and you're not a real estate professional and you get a $50,000 write-off, it only can go against $50,000 in other passive income you may have made that year.
There's a small exception for people who make less than $100,000 a year. It's called the mom and pop exception, but it only applies to people that make less than $100,000, $150,000 a year. So not that that's not a lot of money, but that rule prevents your doctor or lawyer person from investing in syndications and using the bonus depreciation loss to completely offset their income.
Can people retain that bonus depreciation? Can they bank that for like 5 years and use it over the course of 5 years, or is it only good for the year in which it was?
So that's a great tax planning opportunity and also a great question. So what happens is, let's say I'm a doctor and I make $500,000 a year and I invest in a syndication. Let's say I have no other rental income, no other passive income. Let's say the syndication kicks me out a $50,000 loss, a passive loss. Okay, well, cool. I received cash flow. I received rental income, but I got a K-1 showing I have a loss, $50,000 passive loss. I cannot take that against my W-2 because I don't qualify as a real estate professional. So what happens is that $50,000 loss gets suspended and carried forward indefinitely on a form 8582. And if you're a real estate investor, this is the most important form that you can have on your tax return, maybe outside of the one that reports your rental activity. It's form 8582. And that takes all your passive losses that you weren't able to take and it carries them forward. So let's say the next year, now that syndication has income, now I'm actually getting income, let's say $30,000 of net income. Well, my $50,000 loss from the prior year rolls forward and I can take that loss and offset that income from the next year. Remember I said all passive income. So I have a $50,000 loss. If I went and invested in a friend's business and I'm a passive investor, that's passive income to me. I can use that loss carry forward to offset that income. If I bought a little long-term rental, a little duplex by my house and it had income, I can use that carry forward loss to offset that income. Odds are, especially if you're young and getting started in your career and your working career, your tax rate is never going to be as low as it was. And so you could generate, ideally, you could generate tax losses in years where you were only paying, say, 12, 22% federal taxes and carry forward that loss into years where maybe you're in 32% tax bracket, 24% tax bracket. And so, yeah, any sort of loss that you're not able to take, it's not for naught. It gets carried forward until you can actually offset it with other income.
Right. Yeah, that's where the difference between, you know, having just an accountant that you hand your taxes to once a year and someone that helps you tax strategize, I think, is all the difference. And so doing that planning ahead of time is critical there. Is there anything else that comes to the top of mind? We're running out of time here, but really top of mind that you say, man, this is something that I really think people should hear about, know about, think about in the tax planning, tax strategy world.
Practical advice, there's the option to self-direct your retirement account. So say you have an IRA account, say you have a 401k account, and it's sitting on Wall Street, and you're like, I hate this. You know, given this money, there's guys that are controlling it that I have no idea what they're doing. You can self-direct your retirement account, and you can actually buy real estate within your retirement account. So your retirement account is not limited to just Wall Street. You could actually take your retirement account and buy crypto. You can buy other businesses. You can buy real estate with it. You can buy gold, whatever you want to buy with it. There's only a few things that you can't, right? I would say that's one of the most practical things as far as planning goes, is you have to think of the tax code as your roadmap to wealth. So all the stuff that's inside of that code, and you could buy books on it to understand it, or you can hire smarter people to understand it for you and pay them handsomely. If you're just traveling on your real estate journey in your car, well, like, what's slowing you down? Stopping for gas and tolls, like tolls. And think of the IRS as tolls. Like, we want to stay away from the IRS. So the name of the game really is, if we have income, how can we defer income as long as possible? If I receive a dollar, like, I want to push it off. I don't want to recognize income because that means I have to pay taxes. How do we defer income as long as possible? We can do that through cash out refinances. If my property goes up in value, and if I sell at the top of the market, I also have to buy at the top of the market, right? Something I don't want to do. So one thing to defer recognition of income is to do a cash out refinance. The IRS treats a loan as a non-taxable event. You can pretty much harvest your equity gain in there without realizing the event. So that's one way. Another way to defer income, maybe for a later time, is the 1031 exchange of being able to kind of swap your property. It's almost like playing Monopoly when you trade up your four greenhouses for the red hotel. That's kind of what a 1031 exchange is, right? How do we defer income as long as possible? But if we have an expense, if we come out of pocket for something, like we got an improvement, we got the kitchen sink goes out, we want to take that expense because expenses today are generating tax savings today. And so just know the name of the game. That's the road. So our roadmap to wealth is our car is moving, our truck's moving along. We want to stay away from gas. We don't want to make gas stops if we don't have to, or just pit stops and tolls. We have to stay away from tolls, which are the IRS, right? That roadmap, and just steer clear of Uncle Sam.
I love it. Ryan, thank you for your time today. Thanks for breaking down some of these nuanced items for us. Certainly appreciate that and appreciate, the advice, insight you bring to the table here. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, learn more about you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah, the best way is to find me on Instagram and Twitter at LearnLikeACPA. I have tons of content on real estate tax, real estate investing, overall just building generational wealth, and it's on my platform over there. And I respond to all my DMs, so go ahead and reach out.
Ryan, you're the man. Thank you, sir. I do appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, That would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.